Good afternoon. So last time we did some introduction, talking about what operating systems are, this notion that we have this layer of abstraction above the hardware, something that lets us have multiple programs run together without having specifically been written with that in mind, and that provides just a more convenient interface when we're writing programs. We start talking about sort of the underlying mechanisms we use to implement that. And the big one we're going to deal with is this notion of dual mode operation, that the operating system is going to need to do some things that programs don't do, and we're going to make sure programs don't purposely or accidentally do things they're not allowed to do by having the operating system run in this kernel mode and the programs run in this user mode where those operations don't work. And we need the operating system to be able to, well, to do the things that programs request, what we call system calls. This programs wanted the operating system to do something that was special, and also to respond to events on the system. Like if I press a key, I might want to have a different program start running, and the operating system needs to run in order to do that. And if we only have one core, or running something in all our processors, something in the hardware needs to make that happen because there's not an instruction in the program we're running which says, I'm going to switch to the OS. And our mechanism for this was exceptions or interrupts. And everything from system calls, so some things that are deliberately triggered, and these events will start running the OS with the hardware and in kernel mode, which is how we switch back to kernel mode and have the OS do these special operations like I/O, switching programs, and so on. Second to this, we needed a way of abstracting memory. Because we're running our programs directly on the real processors, they're running instructions that can access any memory address. So we need to make it so that that's not dangerous, and so that doesn't get rid of the illusion that the program is written without any of the other programs on the system in mind. That it just uses whatever memory addresses it likes, and it doesn't have to worry, oh, that might be LS's memory address if LS is running, but if it isn't, it isn't. And so we have this notion of address spaces that each program gets its own memory, and we mentioned briefly that the typical implementation of that is this idea of address translation, that one of the special things the OS can do in kernel mode is set a mapping for memory addresses in the program to the real memory addresses on the machine, and by doing that, it can make the program use whatever, allow the program to use whatever memory addresses it wants and make that correspond to what the OS thinks is a good idea. So when we left off last time, we were talking about system calls. In particular, we were looking at how system calls were implemented in XV6 and that work, and I'll get back to that in a bit. First, some logistics. So I mentioned last time we're going to have quizzes on the lecture material. The first one will be released tomorrow and due before class on Tuesday. Quizzes are done electronically. So you're going to have a web form like this, which might be familiar if you're taking 3330. This is linked off the web page. I'll show in a bit. The real one, this is an example one. So when you take a quiz, you'll press button. It will ask you, do you really want to do this? And it will take you to a page like this. There will be the time remaining, which is going to be time until it's due. And you can select options for select all that apply. There'll be checkboxes. And the box around the question will turn green if the answer is recorded. If it doesn't turn green, the answer is not recorded, probably due to some like Wi-Fi or network problem or net badge issue. And you can answer questions here. There's a place for comments. You can write comments in the question, and when you click somewhere else, they'll be recorded when the box is green. And sometime, at some point in the semester, I will read the comments and may give partial credit or take away credit based on them if they show that you understood or did not understand the question in spite of your answers. That's where what you should do if you think, I don't know, if you think the question is ambiguous, please just write a comment. We will read it. We'll use that for grading. And that's how we'll deal with most of that. And when the quizzes are done, you'll be able to go to a page like this. It won't say NaN. It will actually have averages among the class, and it will show you the, you know, what you answered, what the correct answers were, and your score. Each question is going to be out of one. Select all that apply questions. Each part will be worth a fraction of one based on the number of options there are. And on a real example, we'll put the percent of people who answered each option here, and the mean score of everyone here for this example quiz. I don't have that because we don't have lots of people answering it. So any questions on that before I show getting it to it from the website? So from the website, which you will probably find via Colab. So if you go Colab and log in and go to this course and click this quizzes link, you'll get to the actual quiz page. Okay. So questions on that? As I said, first one I'll be released tomorrow. It says 2 p.m. I might get it up earlier, and it's due by noon on, that should be Tuesday. That will be Tuesday. So I will make sure that it is actually due on noon on Tuesday and not Monday. That is a mistake. I'll write a note that I will actually read. So just before class, so you have all of Monday to do it, if that's what you choose to do. And all of the weekend, of course. Okay, so that's on the quizzes. Any questions on quizzes? And so we'll have one of those after each week of lectures. It will be on the lecture material. Since we didn't cover that much this week, we'll probably have less stuff on it. And they'll typically be like around four questions. Yeah.
Are they always going to be open on Friday and you before class on Tuesday?
The question is, are they always going to be open on Friday and you before class on Tuesday? Yes, unless I specify otherwise, which might happen like around break, spring break or something like that. Or before the final, and so on. Yeah.
Were the answers on the demo quiz correct?
I have probably.
It said that you don't need the operating system to check the length of a string on the heap.
Yes.
Wouldn't you need the operating system to access the heap?
So the question is, do we need the operating system to check the length of a string on a heap? So you need the operating system to allocate more heap space. But once you have it, that translation is already set up, and you never involve the operating system anymore. So once you have the allocation set up, the operating system doesn't need to be involved. And this is good because things would be much slower if typical memory accesses always involved the operating system. Okay, so last time we were talking about what happens for the write system call in XV6. So I showed you an example of the write system call. And first thing we did was we called this wrapper function. So this is, in C, we have this normal function call, but system calls aren't normal function calls because they don't use the call instruction. It's not call, we have to use this special instruction, in this case, this int instruction, in order to switch to the operating system and rerunning in kernel mode so we can actually access the console. And this wrapper function is just sets EAX so the operating system knows what the system call is. This is a choice XV6 made, and executes something which causes a particular kind of exception. And there's a table of exception handlers that the processor reads, which is set with this LIDT instruction. So there's this table called on x86, the interrupt descriptor table, which tells you what's the handler function for each kind of exception. And there's an entry that we set in that table which is for the system call kind of exception, the number that we chose for system calls, the designers of XV6 chose for system calls. And the most important thing about this is that we set that table to run a particular function. So we have this array vectors, and it turns out that the entry for tsyscall points to the assembly function vector64. So it's just the address of some assembly code that the processor is going to run when we run that int instruction. But rather than running it like we jump to it, it's going to run it in kernel mode, and it's going to do some extra work so we can return back, like kind of like a call instruction, to the user code in the same place. So on x86, the way that works is that when the processor jumps to this vector64 function, it's going to write out some things to the stack. Most notably, it's going to write out effectively a return address to the stack. That's done by the processor, because if we didn't do that, we wouldn't have any way of knowing where to jump back to when we're done with the system call. And it's going to write out some other information that x86 has chosen to write. So then we have to look at this vector64, and here's the implementation of vector64 in XV6. So it pushes two additional things to the stack, the number 0 and the number 64, and then it jumps to another function, which is also written in assembly, and that eventually calls a function called trap, and that trap function is written in C. And it turns out that XV6 has made the choice that every single exception handler in XV6 looks like this. All of them push something on the stack, then run this trap function in C. So every single exception goes to this trap function. Even though we have separate handlers at the assembly level for them, XV6 has decided that's not really a feature I care about. I just want to have them all in the same place in my C code. So they have separate handlers only because the processor kind of insists on it. So any questions about this procedure so far? Okay. So something you might notice is that this trap function has a prototype where it takes an argument. The argument is this thing called a struct trap frame, a pointer to that. So the job of this all traps code is to set up that struct trap frame. And that's going to contain all the information we're going to need to know to handle the exception. So the assembly code consolidates information like, was it a system call or a key press? And it also gets information like, what were the registers of the user program? It saves those, and those are in the trap frame. So we can access them later, which we'll need to do, for example, if we want to, for this write call, we want to retrieve the argument 1 and hello world. Those are on the stack. To access the stack, we need to know where the stack pointer is. That information is going to be in the trap frame struct. The assembly is going to put it there. Okay, so questions before I move on? Yeah.
So basically, anytime there's a trap, this exact process is followed, and then the difference is the value of the TF, the parameter?
So the question is, anytime there's a trap, this exact process is followed. I wouldn't say exact because it's a different thing than vector64, so there's different constants here. But the difference is just the value of the trap frame, things in the trap frame. And that's how you tell what kind of event it is. And we'll see that in a bit. In fact, on the next slide. So here's part of the code for the trap function. So the first thing it does is it looks in the trap frame and it checks the trapno variable from it. And it says, is it a syscall? And if it is, it does what it does to handle a system call. So the first thing it does when it handles a system call is it looks at this myproc killed. So what is myproc? So myproc is this function in XV6 that when you're writing XV6 code, you'll use probably a lot, which represents the currently running process. So it's a function you can call, and it figures out what's the program that's currently running and using some semi-global data structures to do that, and returns a pointer to information about that. And we'll talk much more about this later on when we talk about how we manage processes and how we schedule them. And one of the things that that struct it returns has is a killed flag. So one of the things we check is, well, this process just made a system call. I first check, was this process killed by something already? If so, I don't want to bother writing the system call. That doesn't make any sense. I'm just going to exit right now and have it run something else. Yeah?
If my process is the current process and that code is executing, how could it be killed?
The question is, how could it be killed? So XV6 supports multiple processors. So the primary way is another a program running on another processor could have killed it. And that killing could not have taken effect until the program had a chance to make a system call.
But if it were killed, wouldn't that if statement not execute?
So what would happen when this if statement is true is that we decided this process is killed, but we haven't finished the action of actually getting it off the processor yet. And this would happen because we decided on one processor, yes, I'm killing this process, I made a note of that, but I don't have a convenient way of stopping it from running on another processor. So the second thing we do is we set this TF, or trap frame member, of the myproc struct. And the reason we're doing that is we're going to later on do some work where we're going to want to read the values of the registers. Most notably, I mentioned that we have the parameters to the write system call, this 1, hello world, and 14, which are on the stack. We need to read those later on. We need to know where the stack is. And the trap frame is going to let us know that. So we store a copy of that in this proc struct so we can retrieve it later, in particular from the next thing we do, which is we call this syscall function. So this is going to use that TF to figure out what operation do I do. So we need to read the, remember, is it a write or is it something else? Remember, that's in the EAX register. We've saved a copy of the EAX register in there. So we're going to read it from there. We need to read the arguments. We can figure out where that is from the stack pointer that's in there. We've saved a copy of the old stack pointer. We can read it from there. So we save that. We run this syscall. And this has the actual implementation for all the system calls. And after that's done, we ask again, is the process killed? And if not, we just return from our trap frame. And I'll show you, talk about what the return code does in a bit, with the code that calls trap does after trap finishes. Let's first talk about what this syscall function is going to do. So XV6 has in syscall.c this big table. So there's some confusing syntax here because most of you don't write code with function pointers all the time. So this is an array of function pointers. Yes, I know the syntax is probably not your first, second, third, or fourth guess for what the how you would declare one of those. I assure you that is the syntax for an array of function pointers to functions which return int and take no arguments. And C supports this syntax where we can write number value to mean that the element number entry sys underscore write, where sys underscore write is a constant that's defined in a header file. In this case, I believe it's 16, points to the function sys underscore write, lowercase sys. Just like if we just assign for each line in the code here. So what we do in the syscall function is first we retrieve the value of EAX, which remember is the system call number. So it tells us which entry in this array is the implementation of the system call. And we check, is that number valid? Is it, you know, not greater than 0 and less than the size of this array? If so, and not null. If so, then I call the function based on that array entry and store its return value in the EAX entry in the trap frame. So I'll first talk about, so we call this function. So this is going to go to the syswrite implementation. And remember that we still have access to, in here, so curproc, this is, at some point we did curproc equals my proc. And this, the function we're calling can still use my proc to access the arguments, and it's going to do that. So note that we're also setting the return code by modifying the trap frame. So what the code that calls trap is going to do when trap returns, it's just going to take that trap frame it gave a pointer to, and it's going to restore all those values into the registers of the program before returning. So if we change EAX in the trap frame, that means when we return from the system call, EAX in the program is now going to have a different value. So this is how we set the return value, just like we would for a normal function, but we can't set our normal EAX, because that's going to be changed by all sorts of things that happen between now and when we return from trap. Yes?
And EAX is the only thing that's going to be changed, the only register that's going to be changed.
The question is, EAX is the only register that's going to be changed. So by the write system call, yes. But we have the option that this function could change other things in the trap frame. And for example, if we have a read system call, it's probably going to change memory pointed to by one of the arguments. And that's a common thing you might see happen. So that we'll pass a pointer as one of the arguments and we'll change memory based on that. We could also change registers in the program if we wanted, so that would typically be very confusing. Okay, so here we're calling the sys_write function in the case of the example we have. And this is what the sys_write function does. So we have these funny arg functions. And what these arg functions do is they look at the stack pointer from the current trap frame. So they read from myproc, read the stack pointer that we saved when the exception happened, and they use that to retrieve arguments from the user stack. The first argument is, this is argument number 0, argument number 1, argument number 2. And remember that the write function took a file descriptor, hence argfd. So that's a file, a pointer, the buffer, hence arg pointer, and a size, hence argint. And these utility functions read from the user stack and return -1 if they can't do that. Why would that happen? Well, nothing is stopping me from doing something like moving a bogus value to my stack pointer and then running the system call. And if I do that, well, I don't expect that to succeed, but it's important that the operating system not crash. So that's why we need to check that. So to make sure that if the program messes up and like sets their stack pointer to this nonsensical value, that we don't crash the entire machine, we only make that single program not do the right thing. In this case, we just return -1 in that case. We could have decided to like exit the program or something, but we definitely need to check to make sure that a program doing an invalid system call is not going to make us, not going to make the whole system blow up. So after we retrieve the arguments, we call another function which actually implements the write, and I'm not going to talk about how that function works today. So questions about what you see here? Okay, so then we have the next part. So we've returned from syswrite, which is going to return into the syscall function, which is going to eventually return from trap. We're going to get to this return statement, and then where do we go? So The answer is that the all traps that piece of assembly code is going to have some code after that, and what that's going to do is in the dot 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 part, we're going to take the trap frame, all those register values, EAX and so on in there, and we're going to reload those, arrange for those to be reloaded back into registers, and then we're going to run this special instruction IRET for return from interrupt, which is going to switch to user mode and to a specified location. It's kind of like a return, but it returns to user mode if necessary. So questions? See here? Yeah.
If you call IRET while you're already in user mode, does it just not do anything?
So the question is, if you call IRET while you're already in user mode, what does it do? I believe it probably triggers an exception. Because it's one of those things you're not allowed to do in user mode.
Oh.
I'm not sure though. Okay, so this is the whole system of what system calls do in XV6. So we have this wrapper function, so in our C code, we call this function called write, which is really a system call. And how that works is the write function is this wrapper. So there's a little teeny assembly function that doesn't run in the operating system. That's part of our program, part of the library we link to. And that uses this special instruction to trigger an interrupt. And at boot time, we arranged for this to switch to a different place, and this is going to call trap. It's going to call trap with the trap number set to indicate it's a system call. It's going to check the trap number, realize it needs to forward to the syscall function, and then it's going to check the syscall number by reading EAX, which we saved in the interrupt entry part. And it's going to use that and know, okay, I need to call syswrite. That's going to read the arguments from the user stack, do the write, and then we're going to restore the registers with some changes for the return value, and then return back to user space, and that's going to then return from the wrapper function, and I'll get whether my write succeeded or not. Okay, so something I like to note about is that we're actually going to have two stacks, and I have that briefly mentioned here, that we have a kernel stack. So what is that about? So let's talk about the XV6 memory layout. So there's something I haven't gone over is I sort of glossed over where are we writing our code versus where's the user code running. I mentioned we have this risk that maybe the user sets their stack pointer to a crazy value, and then we try to run an exception handler, what's gonna happen? That seems bad, so we're gonna talk about how we avoid that and just generally keep the kernel information separate. So on XV6, we have address translation, and we've chosen a particular layout of memory. And what XV6 has chosen to do is that large addresses above this value called kernbase are for the kernel, and they are marked in the address translation as accessible to the kernel only. And they have this very simple mapping to physical addresses, in that starting at this first high address, it maps to real address 0, and then it just goes contiguously upwards. And the kernel is going to allocate its own stack, which is separate from the user stack. And we'll talk about why we do that later. So we're going to allocate some kernel stack in the kernel's part of memory at addresses that user space is not allowed to access. And the processor, x86, has a feature to switch stack pointers when an exception happens, and XV6 uses that. So if we're switching to kernel mode, we're going to change the stack pointer, and this is stored in a special location for x86, But the idea is that when that exception happens, we don't care where the user stack pointer was. We switch to our own stack pointer, which the user can't access memory there anyways. And XV6 has made a choice that every process has one kernel stack. And this will be important later. And we'll change what the kernel stack pointer is as part of switching processes. So this isn't set up on boot so much as it's set up when we start running a program. We choose the kernel stack we're going to use to handle any exceptions which happen from now on. And when we switch to a different program, we switch to a different kernel stack. We'll talk about what that looks like later. Questions about two stacks? Yeah.
What information is stored in the kernel stack?
So what information is stored in the kernel stack? So we haven't been very precise about that, but one example of things that are stored in the kernel stack are the trap frame itself. That's where we're going to find memory for it, because we're going to put it on the kernel stack, and all the temporary values that the syscalls use, for example, are all going to be on the kernel stack. And we need to do this because we don't want to pollute the user space stack. Don't want to have to worry about, did we allocate a big enough stack for this program? All we have to worry about is, did we allocate a big enough stack for ourselves? Okay. So that's on our kernel stack. And as an aside, we could have, inside a system call, it's possible to have like a key press happen and that triggers an exception. The way this works in XV6 is that that won't switch stacks, we'll keep using the same stack. But in all other cases, when we're switching from user to kernel mode, we'll switch to a different stack for kernel mode. Okay, so I've talked about system calls, and system calls are kind of the most obvious kind of exceptions, and also what you'll have to implement for the first homework, which is why I'm mentioning it, so you'll be able to do the first homework. That's why I showed you what the source files were, because you'll probably need to modify some of them in order to add a new system call. But there are a bunch of non-system call exceptions, so like a timer interrupt. So when XV6 starts, it arranges for a timer to tick every fixed amount of time, and the idea is that when that happens, we'll switch to a different program, assuming the current program has run for too long. XV6 keeps things simple and just says, every time that happens, I'm assuming the program ran too long, and I'm going to switch to another program, assuming there is one. There's also fault. So if I try to access, say I'm running my user program and I try to access this kernel memory, I'm not supposed to be able to do that. That's going to trigger a fault. The process is going to say, the OS told me you're not allowed to do this, and the OS gets to decide what to do. So that's a fault, and those are all going to be things that XV6 has to handle. What do you do if the program accesses invalid memory? You probably know the most popular option from Linux, the most visible option, I should say, from Linux is to kill the program with some nasty message, and that's basically what XV6 does, but we need code to do that. Also, we have exceptions for I/O. So if I press a key, as I mentioned, that's going to have to trigger the operating system to handle getting that key to the place where, key press to the place where it needs to go. So I showed you that, mentioned that we had a table of assembly functions, and I showed you the entry being set for system calls. XV6 sets it for every possible type of exception, to always call the trap function. So before the setting it for system calls, they just set it by default for everything else. So every possible thing which could happen is going to run the trap function. So let's look at what these do, each of these do, and where these are handled in our trap function. So we know that they go to the trap function and they follow the same procedure that will save all the registers that were in this trap frame so we can access them and decide what to do. So let's talk about timer interrupts. So the timer interrupt has the number, this number, so this is the trap number, so system call set t underscore syscall. Here we have this other number, and we end up doing a couple things on a timer interrupt. So the most notable is actually down here. So if we're running a program, so my proc, the current process is not null, and if the current process is running, and it was a timer interrupt, we run this yield function. And the yield function says maybe switch to another program, what we call a context switch. We also have some other code which runs on a timer interrupt. So one thing we do here is we have this wake up function. And what the wake up function does is it handles processes which are waiting for some event. In this case, processes which were waiting for a certain amount of time. So there's a system call called sleep, which waits for a certain amount of time. This is how XP6 implements that, that when the timer interrupt happens, we check what processes do I need to wake up. And that's what this code is doing. And it's doing it based on this ticks counter here. We also have this funny LA pick EIO. This is something to tell the hardware we have handled this interrupt. And this is needed for all interrupts, or else we'll have things happen like the interrupt will happen again over and over and over again. So you'll see that for most of the sort of external event type of interrupts like key presses or timer. There's also acquire and release here. We'll talk about those later in the semester in great detail. But you don't need to worry about them for now. So, any questions about this? Okay. So that's our timer interrupt. And probably our next topic after we talk about system calls and so on is going to be how the yield function we're calling down here works. So the other thing we mentioned was faults, like accessing invalid memory. So if you look at the trap function, there's this big switch for handling all the different types of traps, and it has a default case. And if you do something like access invalid memory, it's going to hit that case. And what that usually does is it prints a message. So cprintf means C for print to console. So it prints a message with the process ID, the name, a bunch of other information, and sets the current program as killed. So it just kills your program and prints a message to the console. And that's currently how XV6 handles traps. I would note for your debugging that this prints out a trap number. And in traps.h, there's a list of most of the trap numbers. So if you get something weird happening, you can look up what it is and figure out, is my program accessing invalid memory? Am I dividing by zero? All the various things that might be causing that, and that usually will help diagnose errors like this. So the other case is that we have to handle I/O, and if you look in the trap function, you'll see a bunch of code related to doing this. So for example, IDE is the disk interface that XV6 implements. We have the keyboard, which is also COM1, is a serial port, which is like an external terminal that you would plug into an old machine. So back in the old days, we had dedicated terminals that you'd like plug into something, like a modem even. So serial ports were the way you do that, and COM1 is the name of one of those. So you see these handlers for that, and all the work is in this other function here, followed by this acknowledge the interrupt to make sure the hardware knows, yes, I handled it. You don't need to, you can stop telling me about it. So questions? Yeah.
What exactly is the T underscore IRQ again?
So what is the T underscore IRQ? So I didn't mention. So it turns out that I believe the numbers of these external interrupts are configurable. And T underscore IRQ is the starting number that XV6 has chosen. I'm not completely sure on that, but I think that's what's going on. Okay. Other questions? Yes.
For the trap lane, when are values actually placed?
So when, the question is, when is this filled? This is filled by the assembly code that that is in the dot dots here. Okay? And there's some information we need, like the return, the address to return to, which is written to the stack by the processor, which this assembly code moves around.
There's only one trap frame?
There's only, there's a, when a processor is handled, there's only one trap frame for the current exception. So if we have multiple processors, each of them might have trap frames. If we have a system call, and while we're handling the system call, I press a key, we might have a trap frame for the system call, and elsewhere a trap frame for the key press, but they'll be different. That makes sense? Okay. That's our IO. So we have these functions here which handle I/O. So let's take, for example, this keyboard handling function. So I'll show not the part which actually does the I/O. We'll talk about that much later in the semester. We'll talk about the other thing we need to do. So you saw this wake up function earlier, which was, we saw that being used for processes which were sleeping for a certain amount of time. We're going to use a similar mechanism for processes which are waiting for input from the keyboard. So one of the things this keyboard I/O is going to do is just going to mark processes which were waiting for that key press as runnable. Now you might say, well, it's going to switch to them, right? That's not what the wake up function does. It just marks them as runnable. XV6 has chosen that it will only switch to them when we actually have a timer interrupt or something like that. We'll just mark them as something we can switch to, so later on when we check what to switch to, we'll find it rather than not. Yes?
And the input just gets held till that process is runnable again?
So the question is, the input gets held? Yes. So there's going to be, it turns out, a buffer in the kernel for input before it actually gets sent to the user program. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so something I'd like to note, we talked about exceptions. You can observe these on any machine. So if you run an empty loop like this, and I've shown this sometimes in 3330, sometimes not, and look at the amount of time between this start and end, it's not going to be consistent, and that's mainly because of exceptions. Now you'll see these big gaps and these smaller gaps. So you have these really big gaps, which are like milliseconds, and you have these smaller gaps, which are like microseconds sort of thing, or tens of microseconds. And these are a mix of things that happen that when exceptions happen. And most of the things we talked about don't require us to waste milliseconds, but there's one particular kind which does that. And that's when we need to switch to another program. And this is one of the things our OS is doing, that I don't want it to be the case that you can run your infinite loop forever if there's other things for me to do. And we mentioned the timer interrupt is how we make that happen. So from my point of view, I'm going to be running, I'm going to like checking my time, and there's going to be this million cycle delay where what actually happened is a timer interrupt happened and I switched away from the program. Which means that I somehow set things up so an exception happened, and when I returned from the exception, when I ran the IRET instruction, I didn't end up going to the same program. So we're going to talk about how that mechanism works. This is what's known as a context switch, how we're going to change from one program to another when this exception handler happens. And that's the cause, most likely, of these huge delays up here. The smaller ones might be things like handling keyboard input or disk input or something like that. But probably that doesn't take several milliseconds. So what we're going to have to do is we start running. I guess I should have not marked it off. And we need to save the old stuff somewhere. So the question is, where do we save it? Well, the trap frame already has this information. So saving the old information, accomplished. And we need to set the new ones. And an observation you can make is that, well, we already have that information for the new program, presumably from another trap frame. So this process is called a context switch. So the context that we care about is going to be all our registers, our condition codes. So our trap frame actually does contain the condition codes, the program counter, and also a representation of the address space, which is going to be a page table based register, which we'll talk much more about later in the semester. And what we're going to do is we're going to switch from running process A, where it's on the CPU, it has all its registers on the CPU, they point to things in its memory, and we're going to switch to running another program. And as we do that, we're going to swap a copy of the other program's value registers with the one we're switching from, conceptually. So it might seem like the way we do this is by manipulating the trap frame and then using that same return from exception. This is not what XV6 has chosen to do. So XV6 has chosen to divide up the context switch into two pieces. So the two pieces are going to be that we're going to separately switch between threads and switch between the user address spaces and kernel stacks. So what I mean by we switching between threads, so a thread has registers plus a program counter and a stack. So we're going to switch between threads separately, and we're going to have separate threads in the kernel. So in the kernel, we're going to have, so each process has a thread. So this means that process A is going to have its own stack in the kernel and in user space. And process B is going to have its own stack in the kernel and in user space. And it turns out that stack's where the trap frame is going to be, but we're going to switch the kernel values around, and I'll show you what that looks like in a bit. And separately from that, we're going to switch the user address spaces. So we're going to tell the processor, hey, I don't want to use the old user address space, the old mapping of addresses. I want to use a new one. And we're going to change the kernel stack to use if another exception happens. So that's going to be a separate switch that we're going to do as a different step. And I'm going to focus on the first part, the thread switching, because it is probably the most confusing thing in this class. So here we're running on one stack, we're running in the kernel, and I want to switch to another stack and restore the registers that we previously were using on that stack and jump back to where we were when we stopped using that stack. And later on, I want to be able to switch back to where I switched from. So XV6, we first of all need to save a context. So this is XV6's context struct, which stores the state of a kernel thread, of a thread running in kernel. You might say, there seems to be some missing information here. You remember your x86 registers. So we have four registers. So these are register values. And we have the program counter value. And you might say, you're missing a couple registers, like What about EAX? What about the stack pointer? Where is that? I'll talk about how that works in a bit. And the way we do a context switch with this struct is going to be that we call a function, we have a place to save our old context, which is going to be done with a pointer to pointer. I'll show why in a bit. And we have a place to read our new context from. And this function is going to start running the new context. And when it returns, it's when we've been switched back to. So that is not intuitive. So the way that works mechanically is that we're running code in thread A, and we're here. And we call switch. We're saving A's context, reading B's context. So we're going to go to B, and B called switch at some point. And from that, we're going to that call to switch is going to start running B at the point where it was switched from. Then B later on is going to decide, oh, I want to switch back to A. So it's going to call switch again, and that's going to return back to A. So one way of thinking about this is that you call this function in one thread and it returns in another one. Okay, so any questions about sort of what's mechanically going on here as far as the flow of code? Okay, yes.
So like before we, so we have to manually call switch back to it, switch back to it. So what if we switch to C or something before we switch?
So the question is, what happens if B wants to switch to another thread? That will work. If later on that other thread switches back to A, we'll run A again. We don't have to switch in pairs. I just only did pairs to save room in my slide. If we never switch back to A, then A never runs again. And that might, for example, happen when a process exits. We'll switch away from the process, deallocate its memory, and never switch back to it. And that's how we exit a process. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's go back to the issue I had here of where do we store this extra information? So part of the trick of this is that we're going to, you know, note that we have a pointer to a pointer. So where are we allocating space? And the answer is we place the context at the top of the stack. And this means that that star old is going to be the address of our stack. It's P and new should be the, you know, is the new stack address. That's why we don't explicitly store the stack pointer. It's just because we always know our rule is that the context is always stored at the top of the stack, and we know we aren't doing anything else with the stack because we're not running the thread until we switch back to it, in which case the context isn't valid anymore anyways. Because once we switch back, we're done with it, you can't use it. The thread's already running. So that's how we deal with the stack pointer. The way we deal with everything else is that, well, we're only switching by calling this SWTH function. So a function that we switch to is in the middle of a call to switch. So we don't need to worry about saving any of the caller saved registers. Those are already saved on the stack below the context. So we don't need to do the extra work of saving them again. Because when someone called switch, they saved them already. So switch is not going to bother writing them to the context. So we're not going to have them in the context struct. So that in mind, here is the actual code for the switch function, the actual assembly for the switch function. So the first thing we do, this is 32-bit x86. So the calling convention is that arguments are on the stack. So the first thing is we're loading the arguments into EAX and EDX. Remember, that's our old and new pointer, or from and to contexts. Remember, the from is where we're going to say is a pointer to pointer, so we're going to write the address of the new context to that. And then we save the call these safe registers onto the stack. And this is saved in the right order so it matches up that struct context. If you remember that struct context from the previous slide, it had this in EDI, ESI, EBX, EPB, such that it matches up with what we're writing down. Except, and you might say, what about the address to go back to? I had EIP. Well, the program counter was saved by calling switch, and that's on the stack as it happens. So we already have that saved, and that's why that was the next thing in our struct. And I'll have a picture of what the stack looks like in a bit. So we've saved things like EAX and ECX are saved by the switch caller. We know the stack pointer because that's where the context is stored, it's at the top of the stack, so we can compute the new address of the stack pointer based on that. And we know the new program counter because that was saved when switch was called, so we know where to return to, it's on the stack. So then we save the stack pointer into what the first argument points to. So we store the context pointer, and it's a pointer to the top of our stack right now, and then we switch over to the stack of the thread we want to switch to. And before that thread stopped running, the last thing it did was push EDI on the stack. So if we take the stack pointer where it left off, we can pop into EDI, pop into ESI, which is what it did before that, and so on. And before it pushed into EBP, the last thing that it did that had an effect was call something and save a return address on the stack so you can return to where that call happened. And since I know this is confusing, let's do picture version. So here is the two function stack. The two function, it got set up so it has the saved EDI, ESI, EPX as if running this code, and the switch return address along with the arguments, caller, safe registers, and anything else we're saving on the stack above it. And we're just entering the function, and we just called it, so we're right here, we save the return address because we called the function, that's the x86 how calls work. So we retrieve the arguments where our stack pointer points to that return address as we're doing that. Then we push all these registers and move our stack pointer down. Then we save our old stack pointer based on the argument and switch over to the other stack. So previously our stack pointer pointed here, now it points in the to function where it left off. And note that as we switched away, this from stack looks like a mirror image of the to stack. It's just that instead of having the two threads registers, we have the from threads registers. So we've set the stack pointer, so we're going to pop off all those values, and when we get to return, we have the return address of that previous call to switch in the other thread. And then we return, and we're back, in the other function. So questions on this, since I know it is definitely confusing. Yes?
One of the other signs, but when you have the sign with like the thread A and thread B where they're like calling switch to switch between each other,
yeah.
Does each thread need to like keep track of other threads in order to switch between them?
So the question is, do the threads need to keep track of other threads to switch between them? So in order to call switch, we have to figure out what this second argument should be. So yes, we're going to have to figure out a convention about where do we store the pointers to these contexts. And we'll talk about what that is when we talk about processes in XV6. It turns out that there's a global array which contains, among other things, pointers to all current processes that are running in their context. Yes?
So program counter is also in the context struct, and it's getting saved by the
program. So the question is, what's the program counter in the context struct, and where is it saved? Yeah, so the way our, this is what our struct context is. So the program counter part of it is the actually the return address of switch. That's what they've labeled as the program counter. Does that make sense? And that's how it gets written. So our struct context, remember that this is the stack, because of the way the stack rows, this is the first part of it, the second, third, fourth, and EIP was at the end. So it's exactly that return address on the stack. Okay. Good? Confused? Yes.
From stack, is that what we're switching from, and then to stack is where?
Yes. The from stack is the function which is the stack which we're using when we called switch, and the to stack is the stack we'll be using when that finishes the first time. Yes?
Does the EIP from the from stack get like sent to the to stack to like save? Sort of
the question is, where does the EIP get sent? So the EIP value is this value here. This is EIP. This is what we call EIP in the struct. So it's just where switch should go when it's done. As far as what happens when we do a context switch, we have this trick where because we've set up our context in the right way, we always start execution here in the new thread. This is always the first instruction which runs when we switch to a thread. But we've arranged that we can go to other parts of the code with the return statement depending on where we switched, or we decided to switch away from the thread. Okay. Other questions? Okay. As I said, I know this is probably the most confusing part, thing in the class. Yeah.
Can you go over the picture again?
Okay. So from the beginning, our to stack was I'll get rid of this. Our to stack was set up the same way. So this is the struct context that was set up by a previous call to switch. And what we're going to do is we're going to finish setting up the rest of that in our current thread. So we have the top of it, the return address, but we also need to get the extra saved registers. So now we have our new struct context. So the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to, save the context pointer, save a pointer to that somewhere, and then I'm going to use the pointer from the other thread and go there, and I'm going to read from that struct context to load my registers and decide where to jump to. Is that helpful? Okay. Any other questions? So what are the caller save registers and the switch arguments?
The for ESP EX6.
Oh, what are these? So the x86-32 calling convention is that we have on the stack, we have the return address, and below it we have argument. I think they're in reverse order. I should be obvious from this. I believe, yeah. Argument 2, argument 1, I think. I don't remember. Argument 1, argument 2, yes. We have the arguments in where argument one, argument two. This is just the 32-bit x86 calling convention. From 2150 and 3330, you're probably used to a calling convention which uses more registers. Typically on 32-bit x86, that hasn't been done, mostly because 32-bit x86 only has 8 registers. So they wanted to use the stack more. And so those are just retrieving those arguments that are below the return address on the stack. Other questions? Yeah.
So we see that each thread has their own stack.
Yeah.
So do we assume these are all running on user mode, or is there?
So the question is, each thread has their own stack, or are these all user mode? So this is only in the kernel. So I'll talk later on, probably next time, about how this corresponds to things in user space. But basically, summary is that we have this kernel stack, and at the top of it we have a trap frame. And both of these threads are programs which are in the middle of an exception. And when we switch back to them, they're going to return from that exception and go back to user mode that way. So that's how we do the user part of the context, which happens after we return from the switch function. We decide to return back to user mode. That's where that work happens. So all the registers being saved are registers just used by the kernel and used by like that code I showed you earlier that like implements the system calls and so on. Okay. Yes? Go over these two lines. So this is doing, so ESP is the context we just set up. And this is saying basically *arg1 equals that context. And the second part is saying that the stack pointer should be equal to the new context to use, the one we're switching to. That makes sense? Yeah.
Aren't you putting like a number into the old return address for the first line of the green? I don't figure out that
one. This? Oh, okay. So this is, so first of all, AT&T syntax writes to the destination. The destination is last. Does that help? And the prototype for switch is void. It's probably the thing. So yes, if we cared about the return value, you mean, we'd be putting something in it, but switch returns void, so we don't care. Does that answer your question?
Isn't ESP like a number though? Like the stack pointer is the current stack
location? Yes, so this syntax, 4% ESP, is memory at ESP plus 4. That's what it represents. So this is using ESP as an address, adding 4 to it, accessing memory at that location, reading a 4-byte value, loading that value into EAX.
Isn't that, so that's return address, right? Like you're, are you loading ESP into the old return address?
Like loading, so EAX is the return value in the calling convention. Okay. The return address is on the stack, though.
No, but you moved 4 plus ESP
We wrote 4 plus, this is the first argument. So the stack pointer points to the return address. 4 plus that, 4 plus ESP is the first argument, 8 plus ESP is the second argument, is the location of that. This is reading from the first argument and loading it into EAX. And the first argument's a pointer. The pointer tells us where to write the context location. Question is the diagram out of order? So I've made the diagram so that this is the direction of stack growth. And I may have not been consistent with this diagram, if that's what you mean. I probably, in fact, was not, because it should be return address arg1. That's probably what's confusing you, is that the arguments are, like, I wrote the return address and the arguments in the opposite order here. Sorry. I just wasn't consistent in the order, the direction I was drawing my stacks. So you're right about that. So, yes, so So we have the return address here, and this is 4 plus that is here, and 8 plus that is here. Does that make sense? No? So our stack pointer initially points to the return address. If we add 4 to it on this from stack picture, we go from the return address to the arguments address. We're not reading the switch return address. So this is accessing memory. This is taking the stack pointer, adding 4 to it, the stack pointer, and accessing memory there. So we're accessing memory on the stack. The instruction does not do anything to read the value at the top of the stack.
No, you said you stored the return address on the stack, right?
Yes.
And then when you, on the green line, it goes to that point in memory, right? And then it puts the stack pointer.
The green line? So which one?
So then it puts ESP onto like the place in memory that's the return address?
No, so EAX contains the first argument. So 0 ESP would be the return address, but 4 ESP is the first argument. So it was 0, yes, we'd be writing to the return address, the location pointed to by the return address, which is code, but it's 4, so that's the first argument, which is in a different location on the stack, next to the return address. It's the address of that argument has. We can talk later. So one last, we'll probably review this next time anyways, so hopefully we'll have a time for those of you who are still confused. So one last detail is I'm showing you so far that the assumption that we called switch and we're returning from a call to switch. So one question is, how do we start a new thread? How do we switch to a thread which we hasn't called switch yet? And the trick we're going to do for that is that we're going to set up a stack as if the thread was in the middle of running a call to switch. And in fact, we're going to do better than that. This is the code that XV6 has for creating a new thread. So what it does is it, first of all, it figures out what's the stack pointer of that thread. So it says we allocated some stack space. So we're going to leave our stack pointer. And we're going to put things on that stack, just as if the thread was running. So the first thing we're going to put is a trap frame. We're going to pretend, let's say this thread is in the middle of an exception handler. So if it's in the middle, there must be a trap frame, as if we were in the middle of an exception handler. And then we also need to have the actual place for the trap function to return to. So we're going to actually put a return address as if trap had just been called on the stack. So we're going to set up the stack so when there's a return address ready for when the return line of trap runs, it's going to read that return address. And we're going to put another function call. So we're going to have something for switch to return to, and there's some code called forkret, which is just set up as if it's just the code after a call to switch. So we're going to put a return address for switch to read on the stack along with the saved kernel registers for switch to read. So we're going to just set up a stack with all these values we saw here. But the return address, we're going to just choose statically. We just hard code a value of some assembly code we wrote carefully. And we just write in values for these registers there. And that's how we start running a thread. And so when we do this, we arrange for it to say that we're the stack. If you read the stack and try to figure out what's the program doing, like if you were looking in a debugger, you'd say, oh, this program is in the middle of a system call, it's in the middle of calling switch in a system call. We set up the stack as if that was happening, even though there's no real system call to do it. But we just make the stack have all the same values as if that was happening. So any questions about this setup? Okay, so yeah, so our summary, and we'll review this next time since it definitely needs review, is that the switch function, so we save the registers on the current kernel stack, either when calling the switch function or in the switch function, and then we change to a new kernel stack, which we get a pointer to as an argument, restore its registers, and in order to start a thread in the first place, we just make a stack that has the same layout as if we had called switch. That's what I have for you today, so we'll finish talk more next time. I would suggest starting looking at the XV6 homework, which, because it's on system calls, you don't need the context switch stuff to do it. So you should be able to start that.